psychologist Albert Ellis is credited with coining the term stinkin' thinking. Stinkin' thinking is that all too human tendency to persistently engage with thoughts that do not serve us. Stinkin' thinking is that interior dialogue untethered from reality that we let determine how we live. I'm frustrated with how long the pandemic is going on, and so I start thinking either it's always going to be like this, it's never going to get better, and I get depressed about that, or I think I'm just tired of this and I'm going to quit taking precautions. That's stinking thinking. Or I start a diet and I'm doing well and I'm starting to make progress, and then I see something I want to eat and I indulge in a snack and I start telling myself, you've totally blown it. And in frustration, I just eat all the ice cream in the house. That's stinking thinking. Or we start to treat our fears or our feelings as if they are grounded in reality. And I say, I feel guilty, and that serves as proof that I'm just a terrible person. If people really knew what I was like, nobody would like me. Or I'm angry is proof that I've been treated unfairly and the world's out to get me. That's stinking thinking. And that imaginative act of stinking thinking exacts a very real world toll on our lives. In fact, it can have dire spiritual consequences for us. This morning, we're going to attend Mark's gospel, and we're going to look at a healing that did happen and a miracle that did not because of stinking thinking. If you have a copy of the scripture, would you turn it with us there to Mark chapter 3? We're going to start together in verse 1. The gospel according to Mark chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, and there the scripture says, on another occasion, Jesus entered the synagogue, and there was there a man with a withered hand. And there were also some Pharisees who were looking to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see whether he would heal the man on the Sabbath. And Jesus said to the man, stand up in front of everyone. And then he asked the Pharisees, tell me what is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or evil, to save a life or to kill? But they remained silent. And Jesus looked on them in anger and deep distress because of their hard hearts. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and it was completely restored. And the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. This is the word of the Lord. When I say Pharisees, how do you hear that? You know, they have become a foil for so long for us. Even saying they have become a foil for so long for us is old hat. But for this story to have the effect that Mark wants it to have, we have to hear that word the way that the first readers of his gospel would have heard it. And the first readers of John's gospel would have heard Pharisee means deep disciple. These are the folks in all of Israel who are most committed to doing God's work in God's way. The problem is, along the way, they've substituted their way for God's way. The Pharisees started with a real and truthful insight, and that is that sin leads to suffering. That's true. God created the world to work in concert with his character. And so because God is love, when we all act in loving ways, the world just works. And because God is selfless, he created us to act generously, and when we all act generously, the world just works. And God is holy. And so he created us to act righteously and to seek justice in the world. And when we all do that, the world just works. But when we don't, when we act in ways that are contrary to the character of God, we're fighting against the very fabric of creation, and our sin does indeed lead to suffering. In another church, in another place, Missy and I were home one evening, and the phone rang, and a family called and said, "Can you come right now?" And I could hear the distress in their voice, and so I got up and drove to their house, and their family dog had been struck and killed by a passing car. It had happened hours earlier, but the wife was inconsolable. By the time I got to the house, she was nearly hysterical. And we sat down together, and in her tears, she asked, "Why is God punishing me? Why does God always take everything I love out of my life?" I didn't have any good answers for her questions. I couldn't make sense of where that kind of anxiety was coming from. It was months later before it came out that she had been dealing with a secret sin. And she viewed everything in her life through the lens of her guilt. And rather than deal with the sin, she just lived in her guilt. And that's stinking thinking. Her sin led to suffering. Not that God killed her dog. That doesn't happen. Her life was dominated by guilt, so that no matter what happened, she saw it as a punishment that was due her. Her sin led to suffering. The relational consequences of secret sin becoming not secret. Now, she had taken a step. She'd gone from sin leads to suffering and postulated the reverse of that, as though that were a two-way street, that suffering is always a punishment for sin. And she's hardly the first person in the history of the world to think that the street works both ways. When I was a pastor in Chilton, a woman came and visited the church for the first time, and after worship, a number of congregation members came up and said, "Go see her, go see her. We've been praying for years that she would come visit the church." So I went to see her. And I sat down with her in her home, and she began to tell me a part of her story. She said, "I was recently diagnosed with an incurable cancer." We sat with that for a while. And she said, "I guess this is just what God had to do to get me to come back to church." Now, is that right? Is God out there just waiting to zap us? Does God inflict on us pain and suffering? Does he afflict us with disease to make us change? That's what this woman thought about her cancer. And that is a part of what the Pharisees thought about why this man had a withered hand. And that is stinking thinking. So I sat with the woman and listened to her for a while, and I finally said, I don't think cancer is God's plan for church growth. I do think when everything goes wrong in our lives, something in us recognizes that only God can put it right. Only God can meet our needs. Only God can bless us. And when everything goes out of control in us, we seek him out. By the way, Jesus had this man stand up in front of the whole congregation, and he physically healed him. Jesus, who in the story we read last week said he had absolute authority to forgive sin, but says not a word about sin here. Some people take that first idea that sin leads to suffering, and they think it's a two-way street, and say suffering is always a punishment for sin. And while we're here and on stinking thinking, if suffering is always the punishment for sin is the face of a coin, the obverse side of that coin is this. If you do what is right, God will always bless you with every blessing you want in your life. While we were in one of the churches where we served in Mississippi, this couple joined, and they were delightful people and passionate about the Lord and about his church and devout in the way they lived their lives. And they became teachers in a fast-growing Sunday school class, and they had a compelling life story. They'd both been employees of the state of Mississippi for most of their careers, long careers. That means they never really made that much money. But something changed in their life. They made a commitment to tithe. No matter what else happened, they were going to tithe first. And after that decision, their finances turned around, and what seemed like scarcity before began to feel like abundance. And they are hardly the first people, nor will they be the last people in the history of the world to have that experience. When you grow from being a spender to being a manager, and you discover that discipline yields savings. But something else happened. About that same time, one of them was diagnosed with a form of cancer that is rarely curable. And they were cured. And they took that cure to be a miracle. And I took it that way too. But they took those two distinctively personal experiences. We made a commitment to tithe, and suddenly we were blessed financially. And we made a commitment to tithe, and suddenly there was a physical healing. They took that distinctively personal experience, and they made that into a universal principle. And they began to teach their Sunday school class, if you tithe, God will bless you financially. And if you tithe, God will heal you physically. And that is stinking thinking. And you don't have to live long to know that is not a universal principle. It certainly didn't work out that way for Jesus. So let's go back to that synagogue in Capernaum on that day. And here are a set of Pharisees who've come into the synagogue with the intention of doing evil and killing. And they have in their minds a set of things, you can do this, but not that on the Sabbath. And they have this sense that sin leads to suffering, and suffering is always a punishment for sin. And they saw this man who was suffering with a withered hand, and they said, aha, he's getting what he deserves for his sin. Let's see what Jesus will do about that. And Jesus saw all of that. And he asked the man to stand up in front of the congregation, and he turned to the Pharisees and said, can we talk about the big things? Why are we here in the first place? What do you do on the Sabbath? Do you do good or evil? Do you save or do you kill? And they're silent. And Mark said that Jesus was angry at them. That he was deeply distressed by them because they were hard-hearted. That is a term that is regularly employed by the prophets to describe people who cannot see the work of God in their very midst. To describe people who cannot let go of their stinking thinking in order to receive God's healing. And here is God, in their very midst, talking to them about the very mission of his people, wanting them to see that it is always the right time to do the right thing, hoping that they will adopt as their own the very character of God. But the Pharisees missed it because they were hard-hearted. And at the end of the passage, they demonstrate they would rather go out and team up with an enemy than admit an error. The Pharisees came into church that day, and they're trying to figure out whether Jesus is going to break their rule. What they want is for God to be a scorekeeper, because they have figured out in their own minds, this is the stinking thinking, that there is this game that they can win if they play. There's a set of rules by which the world is supposed to work, and we've got them worked out, and we keep them, and nobody else can, which means we win and everybody else loses. But you and I know, the truth is, if God does not grade on a curve, none of us is coming out of this well. Here is Jesus, embodying the love of God. Here is Jesus, who came to offer us the kind of healing that comes when we live into the love of God. And I can't prove this is right, but I think Jesus wanted to work a double miracle in the synagogue in Capernaum that day. I think he wanted to heal the man's hand, and I think he wanted to give the Pharisees new hearts. But you have to want Jesus' healing to receive it. And the man with the withered hand wanted to be healed, but the Pharisees were more committed to their stinking thinking than they were to new life living. And their hard hearts distressed Jesus and made him angry. Let's not be like that. Can you own the places where you're doing stinking thinking? Does it seem like God's out to get you? Or are you glad that he's getting somebody else for what they deserve? Does it seem like everybody else is having an easier go than you're having? Or that nothing really matters because nothing really changes anyway? That's stinking thinking. And it may be that Jesus wants to heal you of all manner of things today, starting with this. He wants your heart to look like his heart. But to receive the gift of Jesus' healing, you have to want what he wants more than you want to hold on to